Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 5, Hedge Fund Trends and Seed Investments. Steve Terrell, Stephen Giordano, and Ethan Johnson will discuss co-invest vehicles and issues, seeding managers, and hedge fund trends. Now, on to the podcast.
Good morning. My name is Steve Terrell. I'm a partner in the investment management group here at Morgan Lewis & Bacchius. To my left is my partner, Steve Giordano. And to his left is my partner, Ethan Johnson. We're going to delve right into it a little bit here. I'm going to talk a little bit this morning about capital raising, and if I have a little time at the end, some current hedge fund terms that I'm seeing in the market. It's no secret that the first quarter of 2016, we saw net outflows in the hedge fund industry, first time in 4 years. That trend, I think, is continuing into the second quarter. So what we're seeing is that capital raising has become increasingly difficult. Assets are leaving the industry, and managers are spending more and more time and energy on capital raising efforts. With that as background, managers are becoming more creative and flexible in terms of how they address those issues with their business. Regardless of the types of arrangements they're having, whether it be with third-party marketing firms, consultants, et cetera, there is a regulatory framework that still applies, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Now, I'm not implying that managers are tapping new or sort of unknown markets. What we're still seeing is they're leveraging personal relationships, joint ventures and seed capital arrangements where they can, and obviously the holy grail of raising institutional capital. What we're not seeing is managers engaging in general solicitation under Rule 506C. We've had many conversations in terms of that, but for whatever reason, the managers that I've worked with have turned the other way and decided to go the traditional route under 506. But what we have been seeing more and more is managers focusing on their branding, what I call pre-marketing. Now, what is branding? Branding, in my mind, is articulating a message to the market, like I said, almost pre-marketing. And most successful firms at raising capital are the ones that have focused the most on building their brands. Now, that takes a long time to develop, and you have to stay consistent and stay on message. Now, some things to think about when you're developing a brand, before you put together your pitch material, is what are your focus? What makes you unique? Focus on the key differentiator between you and your peers and connect them to your background and experience. What is your culture? What are your beliefs? What are your guiding principles? Tell a story. And once you have that story, align your message to your investors' objectives. That is the most effective marketing that I've seen, and it plays well into your marketing pitches and your materials. Now, like I said before, the message must be consistently delivered and integrated in all of the firm's mediums, including websites, oral presentations, written materials, quarterly letters, and DDQs. Now, with all the focus by managers on capital raising, it's no surprise that these issues remain a hot-button issue with the SEC. Now, advertising is defined under Rule 206(4)(1)(b) of the Investment Advisors Act, and that states that any written communication addressed to one or more person that offers an investment advisory services. Now, that's really broad. It covers paper, radio, television, web, and email. It also includes communications intended for existing investors, if it's designed to get the investor to make an investment decision. Now, the advertisement rules are set forth in the general anti-fraud prohibitions, set forth in Section 206(1) and 206(2) of the Advisors Act, but law in this space is nuanced and has been significantly informed by SEC no-action letters, enforcement actions, and staff guidance. Some examples of advertising: pitch books, market letters, websites, fact sheets, social media. Some communications, although, are excluded from the definition of advertising, and that can be some communications to existing investors, depending upon what that communication is. Also, responses to unsolicited requests. But I will say those are very specific situations, and to the extent that you run across these unsolicited requests, I'd encourage you to reach out to your legal counsel or your compliance professional to determine whether or not there's advertising restrictions. Now, the advertising rule contains four specific prohibitions. One, using an ad that refers to any testimonial concerning the advisor or any advice, analysis, report, or other service rendered by such advisor. Two, using an ad that refers to past specific performance of the advisor that were or would have been profitable unless the advisor complies with certain conditions. Using an ad that represents that any graph, chart, formula, or other device offered can in and of itself be used to make trading decisions without prominently disclosing any limitations. and 5, using an ad that contains any statement to the effect that any report, analysis, or service is free, unless it is free. Now, there is a general catch-all in the general advertising rule, and I'm sure you all have all heard of it before. It's you can't use any ad that contains any untrue statement of material fact or otherwise is false or misleading. And that sort of is the guiding principle in terms of when I look at marketing materials or pitch books. Now, there are some hot-button issues in there I'd like to talk about with respect to those 4 tenets that we talked about. Past-specific recommendations is always a hot-button issue with the SEC. And those are past-specific recommendations or securities that you bought that would have been profitable other than giving a full list of securities recommendations that you've done over the last 12 months. That is specifically provided for in the rule. And what the SEC is really concerned about here with past-specific recommendations is cherry-picking. Now, the default rule is you can't cherry-pick, but there have been some recent no-action letters over the last 2 years, one being Franklin Templeton, which permitted the use of objective non-performance criteria for creating a partial list of your securities, and TCW, which is more recent, which permitted advisors to show the top 5 and the bottom 5. And the takeaway from that is you need to use objective criteria in determining if you're going to create a partial list. Now, one other thing to consider here, which is really a red flag for me, is when advisors want to use case studies or hypotheticals. It's not that they can't be done. People want to show their investment process, their strategy, you know, in a sort of a real-world situation. The key is, you know, not to show performance in that aspect. And again, I encourage you to check with your legal advisors or compliance consultants before putting any case studies in these types of pitch books. Now, one last thing on the general catch-all that I talked about. You basically need to represent to the market that your advertisements are truthful and accurate. And the SEC has caught numerous advisors on this issue over the years. And some examples are implying potential for future profits or returns, overstating of AUM, overstatement of personnel and experience in the market, or stating that unaudited performance figures had been audited. So things to think about when you're putting together your pitch material, truthful and accurate. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about current hedge fund terms. Some of my other partners on other panels have talked about this before, fees, liquidity. But what I really wanted to talk about was gates here. We're seeing fund-level gates, investor-level gates more and more, but also this hybrid-level gate, which is an investor-level gate backstopped by a fund-level gate. So, for example, the first gating mechanism for an investor would be at the investor level. So with respect to the investor's capital account, for example, we're going to gate the investor at a 10% on any redemption date. But that's backstopped by a fund-level gate, which might be a higher percentage. The investor would normally get their percentage out on the investor level side unless we hit the fund level gate threshold, in which case all investors that are coming out on the redemption date would also be cut back pro rata based on the fund level gate. And that's just another means of slowing down the redemption and liquidity in the fund to match the assets underlying the fund. Thank you.
So I'm going to talk a little bit of things that we're seeing more frequently in light of changes in the market. And one of them is the migration to private equity or private equity-like investing. And with that, we're seeing more funds seek traditional PE-type investments and trying to coordinate those investments within their current fund structure. We're experiencing funds that want to just set up standalone private equity funds that have dry powder to make these types of investments to support their existing hedge fund investments that the hedge fund doesn't have the capability to go after. Other funds are trying to find ways within their own documentation to create avenues for the private equity style investments that are generally illiquid or they're just going to hold for longer terms. And there we're seeing some revisions to revisiting to the side pocket mechanisms, to the withdrawal terms, and potentially longer lockups imposed on these investors. And we're usually offering those investors the opportunity to switch over if we're doing it within the same fund. Consistent with that theme, we're also starting to see more in the marketplace of the crossover funds. And these I find very interesting type vehicles because they're very bespoke and they are really designed, or we're designing with our clients to fit the market that they're trying to go after. And by crossovers, the general view has been you'll have a public side and you'll have a private side or private-like side investing in the portfolio, and you may not blend performance, so you may keep a traditional hedge fund performance allocation on your liquid securities. You may have a traditional PE waterfall style on your private investments or the long-term, long and hold type of positions. And you may blend your high watermarks and performance. You may not. You may keep them separate. You may do this to keep a perpetual-like fund that has a limited life on the PE side. And these things have gone into different ways, and we actually have several in the marketplace now, and each one has been different. So they've been very unique products, and ones that some larger institutionals like, because it's allowing managers to take advantage of this unique market cycle we've been in for the last few years. In addition to crossovers, we have seen a real big uptick in the co-investment vehicles world. And we all probably know what co-investment vehicles are. It allows the manager to seek inside money, outside money, to pursue investments that they're otherwise looking at on behalf of their fund. Very prevalent in the PE space. In the hedge space, we are seeing this quite frequently, mainly amongst biotech funds, healthcare funds, technology funds, distress funds. They're very simple to set up. Whether you set up certain terms and how you charge fees will vary from manager to manager depending on the opportunity set that's out there and the need for the capital. But the primary focus on these co-investments are it's to support and enhance the manager's ability with the main fund. But just to throw out a few reasons for, why managers are doing this, they don't have the ability to do side pockets in their funds. They have concentration limitations. They're seeing great opportunities in the illiquid investments or longer-term investment world. Some newer managers are doing it to showcase their expertise and distinguishing themselves from the pack, and that how they can do a deep dive into a company and may be an activist, may not be, which is an area that we're seeing quite a bit of this. And it's also an avenue to raise additional capital or create goodwill amongst your investor base. But in keeping with that theme and this idea of trends in the market, moving over to the regulatory side and the recent examinations that we're seeing of our hedge funds that also is coming on the tail end of the examinations they did of the PE space and the real estate space, and one area that's relevant to these types of structures from the SEC's perspective is your allocation of expenses and how you disclose your expenses and what expenses you're charging through to your fund. What we're learning is the catch-all of the fund will be responsible for the following expenses, including without limitation. If that including without limitation is what you're relying on to get expenses that aren't specifically identified in your fund that are material, the SEC is probably going to say that that's not a good disclosure, and you could be misleading investors, get a deficiency notice on that front. And also have an allocation policy and adhering to your allocation policies, especially when you have multiple vehicles, a side private equity vehicle or your multiple co-investment vehicles or other types of funds or accounts that are also investing in these strategies. You need to have a real clear, articulated expense allocation policy, both in your documents and from a compliance perspective. Types of expenses that they're going after that we're seeing are travel and entertainment around these investments, the consulting arrangements, broken deal expenses, and transactional expenses shared among different funds. One area that the PE world is getting in trouble with is their GP co-invest vehicles when GPs have to add a lot of capital, as we all know, to the fund. A lot of those GP co-invest vehicles do not share in the transactional fees. Many PE firms did not have adequate disclosure on that, and all those fees that they were going into the deals where the GP sponsors themselves were getting free rides. The same problem is existing with the hedge funds and the co-investment vehicles. Many times you'll set up a co-invest vehicle that is there for a deal. If that deal doesn't happen but the manager incurs expenses, those expenses may be picked up by the fund, and most times they are being picked up by the fund. And the co-invest vehicle, although money could have been ready, waiting to go into that, make that investment, doesn't materialize, they get a free ride on it. The SEC wants to see greater disclosure on that front. In addition, we've seen additional exposure on the indemnification provisions in our fund documents. The SEC seems to have, and multiple exams have been focusing on how the indemnity provisions in our documents are working. And in particular, they don't want to have managers be indemnified for breaches of fiduciary duty and the like. And many of our documents, both documents that we draft and that we've seen in other firms draft, contain provisions that say if there's a settlement, because you have to be determined by court, a final determination whether they've breached the fiduciary duty or committed fraud or had committed willful misconduct. But if you settle that out before final determination, the SEC is going to argue that you didn't give a chance, there was a claim of fraud, a claim of breach of fiduciary duty, but it was settled out. And by the way, our documents say that a settlement is not indicative of admitting guilt. So they're pushing hard on those provisions. At this point in time, I'm just noting this to our clients. I'm not changing things in our documents other than to make sure all documents, including separately managed accounts, agreements, and advisory contracts, all have the savings clause that says you can't waive and be indemnified for items that otherwise are not waivable under the law. The last thing I want to touch on before I turn over to Ethan to do some seed deals, it's not a trend per se, but something we're just seeing more common. Given the volatility market, we have seen and witnessed a lot of hedge funds, large and small, where managers have significant capital, close the funds down and flip over to a family office. And that may be just a holding pattern until, you know, the managers get tired of managing their own money and want to ramp back up again. But in that, we're seeing, you know, that transition happen in the market, and there's been some press and some very large managers that have gone through this route. All I can say there is, you know, there's a clear path to doing that for managers. The family office exemption's out there. We've been helping clients fit within that exemption. We've also helped them simplify their fund structures when it's just internal money, not only just from an operational perspective, but if you kip an offshore with FACTA and the like, getting that to be onshore. And then looking at your employment contracts and your comp plans for your team, because you'd like to maintain your team to some extent, and having a good comp plan is helpful. Ethan?
Thank you, Steve. So carrying on this theme of raising capital, getting funds started, different trends there, I'm going to speak for a few minutes on seed investing. In other words, the contribution of initial capital to a startup fund or a startup manager. This continues to be very relevant. A recent study has shown that of all the managers in the study, which was primarily smaller or mid-sized managers, as many as 65% of those managers had received some form of seed capital from founders or from professional seed capital providers, and that overall this study estimated that 15% of all hedge funds out there have had some form of seed capital over the years. The benefits for taking in seed capital varies under facts and circumstances. As we've heard, it's harder and harder to raise capital these days for the smaller managers. By far, I think a majority of the inflows into hedge funds go into the larger, well-known managers, and that's certainly the trend from the institutional investor side. So it's a struggle often for mid-size or smaller managers to get the critical mass. Some strategies, it's essential, like a fund-of-funds activist and others. You really can't start small and grow. You really have to have enough to be able to diversify among a portfolio of hedge funds or other things. So you need that initial capital. It also helps to create contacts and build up relationships and create a starting basis that would be very difficult to start without that backing of a seed capital investor. Stamp of approval, tapping into their network of contacts, not only with investor contacts, but service providers and back office services and things like that. So it can be quite a beneficial at the starting point. And as I said, many managers will go to the seed capital sources for this. Some of the drawbacks, the deals negotiated with the seed capital investors, the professional ones, are very difficult and require significant financial compensation. I'll touch on that a little bit more. The seed capital investors will require a lot of transparency and control over operations. Also, I've seen sometimes that a new manager gets $25-50 million contributed by the seed capital investor and says, okay, you know, I can get started now. And they kind of then, you know, maybe they lose steam or they lose the initiative to keep raising capital. And so I've seen that as a bit of a drawback, just to be kept in mind, but there's no reason not to go through the seed capital process. There are other alternatives to seed capital, but this is a very traditional approach. There are typically different, maybe two different themes in seed capital investing, where a seed investor will come in and will take an equity interest, typically in a general partner maybe of the funds and perhaps in the fund manager itself, and will benefit from the flow of capital and income allocated to it. Or it may just be simply a revenue share where the seed investor takes an equity interest. Typically, the distributions will be net of fees and expenses that the manager and the funds bear. In revenue sharing, often it's on a gross basis. The amount and timing will vary based on various facts and circumstances. You'll often see, it's hard to generalize about the seed deals, but, you know, to establish certain bogeys in this, the I think we typically see the share of revenue that the seed capital investor will demand, either through revenue sharing or as an equity investment, is somewhere between 10% and 40%. It's hard to generalize on that. You know, and again, it'll depend on the circumstances of the manager, their sophistication, their track record, and type of strategy. That will depend. And then, as I mentioned earlier, there's also the factors of whether it's a gross deal or whether it's a net deal in the sense of after fees and expenses. The primary theme that one runs into in either representing the seed investor or the startup manager is the fact that your seed investor is going to want a good return on its investment. It's going to want safety and certain controls so that it can either pull out or it can make changes if it doesn't like the direction that the manager is taking and that it sees risks. On the other hand, for the manager, while they're excited to get the capital, they don't want to be burdened with years of sharing fees and having the oversight and control of the seed investor. We try to negotiate, you know, when I'm representing the manager, maybe a five-year deal whereby the manager will promise that the seed investor will get, you know, that percentage of revenue for a 5 years, and then maybe after that, that amount will ratchet down the percentage, but the seed investor will continue to have the right to invest into new products that are rolled out by the manager. On the other hand, the seed investors usually come in with an expectation that they're going to get their percentage of fees and revenue for life. And there won't be any end point on it. And it's all just a matter of negotiation and, you know, the strength of the different positions. So I think that puts a wrap on seed investing.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.